Good afternoon. It is 3:15, Wednesday, November 27th. This is the Thanksgiving Eve edition of the TDN Writers Room podcast. I am Joe Bianca, associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News.
I'm Bill Finley, and true story, I once won the Eclipse Award version of writing for dog racing. Can anybody else say that that will be on their epitaph?
No.
Okay.
In a word. I don't know if we want it.
Yeah, right. Would you even want that?
It's Alan Carrasso, managing editor at the TDN.
Ryan DiNato, racing editor at the TDN and managing partner of Franklin Ave Equine.
So this week on the TDN Writers Room podcast, we welcome Dr. Greg Ferraro, the newly appointed chairman of the CHRB. He is our Green Group Guest of the Week. The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by the Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With more than 500 clients in the horse business, they were bred to save you money. For more information on how they can help you, visit www.greenco.com. All right, so I guess we'll start with just a little bit of an intro to you. You used to be a racetrack veterinarian, and before that, and then you were also the director of the UC Davis Veterinary Medicine Center for Equine Health. I wanted to ask how that kind of experience will help inform and guide the CHRB under your tenure.
Well, having a complete understanding of how the backside works, what race horses undergo on a daily basis, how the training affects their soundness, how different methods of treatment are available, and then you tie that with the academic research end of it, where you have a better understanding of what causes some of these lamenesses and eventual breakdowns and looking to avoid those situations.
Dr. Ferraro, it's Bill Finley, and thanks for joining us today, and congratulations on your new job. And when you first were able to speak publicly as the head of the CHRB, you had some quotes that were kind of jumped off the page and were very statements that were very strong. And the one that I will always remember and I jotted down was, you said the days of permissive medication are over with. Could you expound on that? Does that mean you foresee a future of California racing where there is no Lasix of any kind? And, you know, will we have virtually nothing more than hay oats and water racing so far as you look forward and the things that you are hoping for California racing?
Well, let's start with a little background. You know, in the late 1960s and early 70s, racing in the United States and California made the decision to go with permissive medication. And I was one of the ones that people that argued for it. We thought it was the right way to go. But it became apparent by the early to mid-90s that this choice was probably a mistake. Since the mid-90s and the two decades had passed, there are several red flags that came up. Decreased number of starts, increased number of injuries, increased severity of injuries, things like that, that we began to, you know, call the industry's attention to it, but really slow to change. Once they had taken the path of permitted medication, reluctant to change, in spite of the fact that the rest of the world was doing without. And so, given the crisis that California has recently gone through, out of crisis comes change, and that change is, yes, we're going to be a no-medication state in the end by the time this process is over with.
Hi, this is Alan Carrasso, and thanks for joining us. How long do you foresee the process taking before you feel that California will be entirely medication-free?
I think you'll see major changes in the next 12 to 18 months. We have a mandate from the governor, as you probably well know, to make these changes, and we're determined to carry them out.
And as far as the whip rule, which was supposed to have been discussed or was at least on the agenda for last week's meeting, but was tabled or deferred, what's your personal stance on whip use? What do you think is an optimal solution?
Well, we have to make some sort of a change. The public won't stand for the rules as they stand now. They just, it's probably the number one complaint that racetracks get. And so we will be making a change. The reason we postponed it from last month's meeting is because the newly formed Thoroughbred Safety Consortium, we wanted to give a chance to consult with them to see what their plans were, if they had feeling one way or the other. It would be nice if all racing jurisdictions adapted the same rule.
Hi, Dr. Ferraro. This is Brian DiDonato. Now, we've seen a little bit of an exodus with some trainers kind of leaving California, or I know a lot of them have gone to Kentucky or sent a strain to Kentucky, and a lot of them applied for stalls at Oaklawn. What do you make of that? Do you think we're going to see more of that? What's your take?
Well, it's a possibility. If you look at the Thoroughbred Safety Consortium, that's Kentucky, New York, the Stronach Group, they're basically adopting the same rules California already has, 14-day stand-down rules, many of the same rules. So someone leaving California thinking they're going to Kentucky or New York and find an easier rule situation, I think they will be surprised that there's not much difference. In terms of Oaklawn Park, I can't speak for them. I'm sure that given their purse structure, many people will go there. But we have to uphold what California standards are. And if we're going to race in California and keep the public and the politicians happy, we just have to go the no medication route.
Dr. Ferraro, this is Joe Bianca again. These CHRB meetings have gotten pretty contentious with a lot of anti-racing protesters, big presence of PETA and such. How much do you take into account what they're saying? Do you completely ignore them? Do you acknowledge some arguments? How do you approach that when there is such a virulent anti-racing presence at these things?
You know, actually, a PETA organization, you can work with them. I mean, they make public statements that seem to be pretty contentious, but when it comes down to working things out, they seem to be willing to talk. The local demonstrations we had at our meetings, their basic intent is to put us out of business. And so they have a right to speak and a right to express their opinions, but the CHRB is going to move forward in what's in the best interest of racing.
And Dr. Ferraro, you are right now more closely positioned of anyone in racing to be a direct link to Governor Newsom's office. And before you took this job, Governor Newsom had some comments that were rather scary for the horse racing industry, particularly in an interview with the New York Times. And what do you sense is his state of mind right now about racing? Is he happy that racing is going forward with so many reforms? Is he content with what is happening? Or is he still maybe, you know, got his finger close to that trigger that he may make moves if there are continued problems to perhaps ban the sport?
I think, in the period following last winter and spring's problems at Santa Anita and previous to my appointment, I think he was very concerned and seriously considering precluding racing in the state. Since there's a new board appointed, he asked us to submit a list of intended reforms, which we have submitted to him and he has approved. And I think if we move along the path to adopting the reforms that we have listed for him, my feeling is that the state of California does not have to worry about Sacramento causing a cancellation of racing.
Okay. And one of the many issues that have been out there is the synthetic surface issue. And a lot of people are wondering if the Stronach Group will take the initiative to replace the main track at Santa Anita and put in a synthetic track. But it shouldn't be forgotten that once upon a time, the California Horse Racing Board had ordered the tracks in California put in synthetic surfaces, and then that was all changed. Is there any mood among the CHRB to dictate or mandate that the tracks go back to synthetics?
At this point, we're not going to dictate or mandate a track. What we're after is a safe track. And the things that we've mandated for the immediate Santa Anita meet is that under inclement weather conditions, they will not race until such time as the track is considered normal and safe. In regards to the long-term changes in synthetic tracks, we're not opposed to synthetic tracks. We feel that there may be some advantages to them, but at the moment, there's no good product that fits the needs of Santa Anita. If you look at the synthetic surfaces that are workable at Woodbine and Golden Gate, they have ambient temperature and moisture content that doesn't vary very much. Where Santa Anita, the problem that they had before was rain in the wintertime, cold in the morning, and 100 degrees in the afternoon. And those products just broke down and both at Del Mar and Santa Anita, and they weren't satisfactory. So the talk to move to synthetic is, what synthetic? Show us a product that, is going to be serviceable over time. It's a considerable investment. You can't expect a racetrack to make that move again, given the past history of it, without having pretty good assurance that the product they're going to use is going to last.
I want to go back to that statement you made that Bill brought up before, because it was a pretty bold statement to completely eliminate race day medication in California. You also said we expect opposition on some of these goals. Has that been your experience? What kind of feedback have you gotten?
Well, there's some opposition, but I think that most of the horsemen in California, not all of them, but most of them realize that we're in a crisis situation and it's time to make a change. Some of the reforms they may not agree with, not all of them I may agree with, but we realize that we have to make a change if we want to survive here. So I think in general, with a few exceptions, most people are accepting the direction we're going.
And Dr. Faro, you also brought up the point of Santa Anita canceling if the track is deemed to be unsafe. We've already seen Del Mar take precautions, canceling cards on two Thursdays in a row and canceling them well beforehand. But when Santa Anita said they would do this, there was no specifics involved in it. And in your mind, what would dictate the sort of racing surface where it would be appropriate for them to cancel racing? And will the CHRB be advising them or telling them that, perhaps we think, hey, there's bad rain coming, you shouldn't race on, say, Friday or something like that?
Well, in terms of this weekend at Del Mar, the CHRB did not give any recommendation to them. This is strictly a Del Mar management decision, and they just didn't want to take the chance on running on an unsafe track. And so they felt that it was best for them to preclude racing last Thursday and this coming Thursday and try to race on a drier track over the weekend. But we haven't mandated anything to them. We've worked with them and cooperated with them. They've consulted us on every move they made, but we're not demanding anything out of Del Mar.
All right, Dr. Faro, thanks so much for joining us. Good luck.
Okay.
Thank you, Dr. Faro.
Thank you.
Mike. The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As The Green Group Guest of the Week, Dr. Greg Ferraro will receive a free one-hour tax consultation. The Green Group, bred to save you money. For more information on how they can help you, visit www.greenco.com. So we'll start this week with the major news of the weekend, which was off-track news, which was the revelation that Phoenix Thoroughbreds and the Phoenix Racing Fund, the principal, Amer Abdulaziz, was named in a U.S. court proceeding as, quote, a key figure in a money laundering operation. And he's also alleged to have stolen 100 million euros from a sham cryptocurrency. Again, this is all alleged, but obviously big news, not just here, mainly overseas, because Phoenix was in five continents and had over 300 horses, including stallions and broodmares. So a major, major deal that will have ripple effects throughout the industry, I would think, even though they haven't been around for that long. It's a little early to have any strong conclusions about this. My main thing is more of a general point that when these entities start showing up and start throwing around this kind of money out of nowhere in racing, I think it's healthy to always have a heavy dose of skepticism on where the money's coming from and if the money's actually real. Because if the allegations are proven to be true, in this case, it was basically a shell company. There were no actual assets being traded. Again, it's not a good look for racing, for someone like that to have this easy entree into racing and spend supposedly all this money and get top trainers and top horses, and then it turns out to be a complete fraud. So if that is the case, I think racing has a little bit to answer for here. And yeah, just in general, when people start showing up out of nowhere and spending 8-9 figures, be skeptical.
Well, I would certainly agree with that. And, there's so much that we don't know at this point. And Whenever I see these stories, I don't even understand these things. I mean, it gets into a world where, you know, people deal in things that just go over my pay grade. And I don't even get what money laundering is. And, you know, we'll see how this all plays out. But there's so many unanswered questions right now. For instance, you know, the number that keeps getting thrown around is that they have 300 horses. What is going to happen to these horses? I mean, will we literally see a sheriff sale, like, you know, with the IRS or something auctioning them off, or, you know, the FBI, you know, if he's proven guilty and the man has maintained his innocence. But, you know, you can speculate where this is going and the what ifs if he is found guilty and this, these are proven to be true. And, you know, this is just such a bizarre situation. And, you know, it's fascinating. It is a dark situation, but it's fascinating. I don't think we've seen anything like this before. And, you know, I just wonder where it goes from here.
Yeah, well, just before I get to you guys, this is all based on Racing Post reporting from Sunday and Monday. They also said that the fund has been placed into voluntary liquidation. They didn't give any details about what that specifically would entail, but I just wanted to add that.
Yeah, I mean, and I'll say, I don't know the answer to this question. If they were pointing horse X to an allowance race, you know, next week at Aqueduct, can that horse run? Mm-hmm. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I would guess the answer is no, but I haven't heard or read anything about that.
They had one in today, Lady Apple, in one of the races at Zia. She scratched, but she was at Remington, and they've had a herpes outbreak there. So I think she was probably going to scratch either way. I'm not sure if anyone else has been entered since then. But I agree that the idea of maybe there being a huge dispersal is obviously interesting. It'll have a big impact on the market. Even if you look at what they spent, almost $4.1 million at the American two-year-old sales this year. At Keeneland September alone, either by themselves or in partnership, they spent $4,645,000 on 14 horses. They bought another one at Saratoga. I mean, there are a lot of unraced horses, young horses that they have, and obviously stallion shares and everything else. There's a lot of high-value horses. It'll be interesting if they ever hit the market.
Joe, I like how you worked sham and alleged into your intro there.
We've got to have both, otherwise we get sued.
You know, I'm a bit naive where it comes to this. I'm a horse racing fan, so I like to see good horses and well-bred horses that bring a lot of money and come out and run well. So, I mean, it's disappointing. I don't think anybody is ever too taken by surprise by something like this. But yeah, I agree. From an optics standpoint, it's another black eye.
I think the really incredible thing is just how kind of, if it's true, how brazen it was talking about how this is the, you know, transparency is our most important thing, and then it turns out to be the exact opposite.
Yeah, that's the best part, is that they build it as the world's first regulated right. thoroughbred fund, not mentioning yeah. that it wasn't actually regulated at all at any point. But right.
he did an interview at Maidan with Nick Luck, right. and was just effusive about how transparent it was going to be, and yeah. Just SMH.
Most transparent fund ever.
You know, I'm going to actually disagree with you guys on one thing. I don't think this really is a bad thing for horse racing, at least in the sense that you're talking about. Because, no, but like with the breakdowns and everything, people blame horse racing. They blame the horse racing industry. They blame the people. I don't sense that that's the case with this. I mean, if the guy was indeed laundering money, allegedly, alleged sham of laundering money, well, it doesn't really matter, I think, to the general public how he was allegedly laundering the money.
Yeah, that says allegedly.
Yeah. You know, he could have been dealing in, you know, anything, you know, laundromats or something. I mean, again, I don't get money laundering. It's a thing that, like, you know, people do that is just so mysterious to me and everything. So I don't think that horse racing is really going to get a real black eye, especially when, you know, everything else is going on. It was just his vehicle to do something allegedly that was a misdeed. And, you know, it could have been any kind of industry and business. I guess the guy just liked horses. I don't know.
I agree. I don't think it's going to be a huge black eye to racing. I think racing probably has bigger problems right
exactly.
now. I think it brings up an interesting question about money laundering and racing in general. I know it's been in quarter horse racing. It's something that's come up more frequently, but I mean, chances are he's not the only one.
Yeah,
it's been going on forever,
right? Yeah, I mean, Joe said that.
Joe said that
in his introduction. I think he made a very good point. Mm-hmm. You know, is this just the one guy that got allegedly caught where others have been doing similar things. We don't know.
Well, that also happened, I think, maybe about 10 years ago or so with drug cartels.
Right.
And quarter horses. It was quarter horses, not thoroughbreds. But there were major figures in the Mexican drug cartels who were laundering money through racehorses. So, yeah, this thing's going on. This thing's been going on for a long time. We don't know everything that happens behind the scenes. But the only thing I would say about it, I don't think I say it's a black eye for racing, because I think the story is a little bit bigger than racing. If the guy stole really nine figures, I would just say that it doesn't reflect well on the people that welcomed him with open arms without seemingly doing any due diligence to see if he actually had the money. It kind of reminded me of it's a great 30 for 30 about a guy that bought the New York Islanders with essentially no money.
Oh, I remember. Yeah.
I forget the guy's name, but he was like a local guy. And he was about to sign the deed of sale to buy the New York Islanders. And then they were like, do you actually have any money? And he was like, well, I can do this and I can do that. And it's like, eventually it fell through. But I don't know. I get it that if a guy shows up at the auction and he wants to spend all this money, like, you're not going to ask too many questions. But I don't think racing should be totally let off the hook for letting him build this so big in such a short amount of time. So in continuing with the TDN bummer writer's room theme that we've got going on these days, there's a story this week in the TDN by T.D. Thornton that, I mean, it's kind of gross. The headline is Delaware horsemen face penalties for unauthorized shockwave therapy. And it's about an owner and a trainer at Delaware Park. They're appealing their fines. They got 6-month suspensions for unauthorized shockwave therapy use. So stemming from an investigation into the catastrophic injury and euthanization of a 1-2 ship-in favorite that was plummeting in class off a 4-month layoff this past summer. The horse's name was Glenn Cairn, and the owner is David Nielsen. Trainer is Anthony Pecoraro. Honestly, I'm going to ask this. This isn't a rhetorical question or a sarcastic question, because this kind of stuff happens all the time. The horse doesn't necessarily break down all the time. Are there that few places that you can send racehorses that don't want to run anymore and are too unsound or too injured to run, that it seems on a daily basis you get these class plummeting horses that people are trying to get rid of? Very obviously, blinking light, trying to get rid of this horse. And it's such a bad look. And we've talked about this before on the podcast, but is it really worth it to try to squeeze a couple last dollars out of a horse before they break down? And isn't there something better you can do for this horse? I get that racing is a business and you try to recoup your investment, but this stuff has broader implications in racing when horses are very obviously being gotten rid of and then they break down and you never hear about it. You never hear about alternate possibilities for these horses. You just kind of accept it as a natural part of the game. And to me, that's freaking unacceptable. And it happens almost all the time. This one made news, but because of the shockwave therapy, I think that's kind of a key word that's going on right now. So my question is, what else can we do for these horses other than these people plummeting them in class to get rid of them?
Well, I think the answer is that it's up to the individuals involved. And I mean, I think, like, we kept throwing around that allegedly word with Phoenix Thoroughbreds. It's important to say that I don't think these people have had, you know, the full hearing and trial, mm-hmm. et cetera. So, you know, maybe there are some circumstances that will come out. But, you know, what we know so far, I agree with you, Joe, it looks pretty ugly. But it's about the broader sense of doing the right thing. And, you know, when racing tells the general public and PETA and the politicians, oh, you know, everybody cares so much about the horse and everybody wants to do the right thing by the horses and everybody is so sick and saddened every time there's a breakdown. Well, by and large, that's true. We all understand that. But it needs to be 100%. It can't be 99%. And, you know, fortunately, this situation didn't seem to catch on with PETA or the mainstream media or anything like that. But had it, you know, this gives them more fuel for the argument. Hey, you guys don't give a crap. And, you know, they'll say, well, wait a minute, we do. But, well, no, you don't, because this type of situation was allowed to happen at Delaware Park. And, you know, we see this sort of thing all the time. And, you know, again, important to say that we don't know all the facts here, but it appears that this horse was just treated completely as a commodity to squeeze every last nickel out of, rather than a living, breathing creature that was probably at this point in its life deserving of a humane retirement and not put back into the starting gate. And racing failed.
Mm-hmm. 100%.
I'm not at all trying to sound like an apologist, in any way, shape, or form. This story doesn't look particularly good, the details that we have. I think the only thing I would say is it's tough to know. It's sort of a fine line. It's not like I can't imagine they sent the horse out there knowing he was going to break down. Obviously, they didn't follow, you know, the rules and everything. But where do you draw that line? I mean, if a horse is slightly, I don't even, you know, it's a tough thing, especially with cheaper horses. I mean, I don't really know how to put it, but it's a tricky thing to figure out.
Well, Brian, I think, and I understand what you're saying, but I think if the story didn't involve shockwave therapy, it really wouldn't be much of a story. Okay, you know, horses drop in class and, you know, they could be perfectly sound and still break down and it would be hard to point fingers. And I said this, I wrote this in the TDN when the Safety Coalition came out with their announcement a week and a half ago or so. You know, I pointed out that while I applauded them for it, I pointed out that there were many things that were left unmentioned. And one of them was shockwave therapy. I mean, it's one of those things. I'm not a horseman. I'm not a vet. I don't really understand what it is. I don't really understand, you know, why it's bad, why it's good, et cetera. But I know it's controversial. And, you know, here it crops up in the story. And my guess is that it's not a good thing for the horses. And it's one more thing racing needs to deal with. You know, are you going to allow this or not? And if you're not going to allow it, you know, make sure that you throw put the fear of God into these people that if they get caught using this thing. And, you know, that doesn't mean the horse is necessarily going to break down. But, you know, we connect the dots here. You know, shockwave therapy, huge drop in class, horse breaks down. Again, we talk a lot about the optics and what it looks. It can't look any worse than that.
I agree with that. I think it's interesting that the trainer was also fined. Obviously, again, we don't know a lot of the details, but generally I wouldn't expect the trainer to be really that heavily involved in something like that and aware. I mean, I think there are a lot of owners who probably aren't aware that their horse is getting a treatment like that. So obviously, again, we don't know the details. There's probably some reason that he was also fined, but I think it's a little interesting.
I mean, I think we just need to do a better job of red flagging these horses. How does Delaware Park allow an entry or how does horse racing allow for these types of precipitous droppers to start, to enter the gate? I mean, I think the story also said that that the vets checked him out and he was just pronounced fit to run. So it's just one of those things. I mean, how can we sharpen the focus and how can we do a better job? But I also might take issue, Bill, with the correlation between the shockwave and the resulting injury. I mean, there's no way to say that there's a one-to-one relationship that because the horse underwent shockwave therapy, which has – Dan Ross wrote a great story about the shockwave therapy and what it does and what it doesn't do. And it's just hard for me to connect the dots there and say it happened because, you know, the horse had shockwave therapy and – it's a bad look. I agree.
I guess the thing is that is the regulation, so they should be following the regulation. And if the rule is it has to be vet overseen and all that.
I also wonder if there's latitude to increase these fines, because $1,000 fine seems
nothing.
Didn't they give them 6 months too?
That's the bigger thing. Yeah. That's the bigger punishment. I'm not going to say I have no firsthand knowledge of anything in this particular case, so I'm not going to say they were trying to break the horse down or they knew the horse was unsound. I'm saying as a general rule, this stuff happens all the time in racing. Huge class plummeters that don't get bet or ice cold on the board and either get pulled up or run at the back of the pack. Like you said, like the vet said that this horse was ready to run. So at a certain point, I think it becomes incumbent on the owner and the people that have the horse to actually do the right thing instead of trying to squeeze a couple last dollars out of a horse that clearly is on its last legs racing wise. There was one other horse, if you'll indulge me for a second, that's running on the New York circuit. And this is a different thing because I don't think this horse is unsound because the horse runs all the time. So he can't be really unsound. It's a horse named Azadine, and it's owned by Knight RB Stables and Naipaul Chatterpaul, trained by Naipaul Chatterpaul. This horse was a former Chad Brown horse, was claimed from Chad Brown last summer, and has run 15 times since and runs very frequently and has been beaten less than 10 lengths twice in those 15 times. Like, you look at the last seven or so races, 10th beaten 15 and a half lengths, 6th beaten 18 and three-quarter lengths, 7th beaten 16 and three-quarter. Like, it goes on and on like this, and the horse runs every 7 to 10 days. And at a certain point, it's like, just let this horse go be a pony. You know what I mean? And that's I have a big problem with this. We have this front in racing that says we all care about the horses so much. They're doing what they want to do. We're not forcing them to do anything. We're heartbroken when something bad happens. This is an example of a horse that should not be racing. Like, the horse gets trubbed and is at the back of the pack every single time he runs, and yet he's still out there and is in the entry box every week. I have a major problem with that, and he's not the only one. This is just an example that I know because I've seen this horse a million times being a New York better. I just have a major problem with what we say in public about racing and what goes on behind the scenes a lot of the time, and whether it's the Delaware story or whether it's these running these non-competitive horses over and over and over again. This is the stuff that has to be cleaned up. Like, I understand that it doesn't get the headlines that the California breakdowns do because PETA has latched onto that and everyone has a tally in their mind of the horses that have broken down. But this is the stuff that happens day to day in horse racing that we got to get rid of. I'm tired of it. I'm tired of us saying one thing and then allowing this garbage to happen on our watch.
So you don't think that ninth place finish for maiden special going 9 on the grass, followed by the 6 furlong maiden 20?
I thought that was the day for Azzedine.
Well, John, I tell you though, I agree with everything you said, but you know, there's still another perhaps chapter to this. I don't know if I never even heard of this horse until you brought it up.
You gotta be a real degenerate.
You bet maiden 20s at Aqueduct and looking at horses that from Nate Paul Chatterpaw. You need some help, pal. There's another chapter to a story of a horse like that. It's called Mountaineer Park.
Yeah.
You know, somebody buys the horse for $1,000 and it's in for maiden 4 at Mountaineer.
Right.
You know, and that is a slippery slope, right, where you really get worried about the horse's future. But, you know, I agree with everything you said, but, you know, and Brian sort of brought this up when we were talking about the Delaware horse. It's difficult because, you know, the man does own the horse and, you know, he's not breaking any apparent rules. So what do you do about something like that? You know, at some point, if it gets so bad, you know, the stewards can just say, you know, we're not going to accept your entries here. But, I don't know. I totally agree with you. I think that it's sometimes it's difficult for regulators and stewards to deal with a situation like
definitely
that.
Definitely. And they had a fix for this, or a proposed fix for this, at Aqueduct in the winter. I think, I don't know if it was last year or a couple years ago, where if a horse was beaten a certain amount of lengths, they had to then come back and work out in a certain time in order to be allowed back in the entry box. And I don't know if that's the case anymore. And a lot of people didn't like it. A lot of people thought it was arbitrary. So you're right that it is hard to have these regulatory fixes for this kind of thing. But it really bothers me when obviously non-competitive horses are allowed to keep running at these tracks. Like, I don't know.
How much has he earned this year?
Let's see.
There's the program in New York. When you run a certain number of times, you're like a platinum member. I'm sure he gets the extra bonus.
He's run 14 times and earned $16,000. So
probably not breaking even.
I guess maybe that's worth it. These like, back to the Delaware thing very briefly. There was also a thing that happened at Delaware last summer, the summer before, where one of the gate starters got caught punching the horse in the face four times in a row. And obviously it gathered steam and outrage on social media, and they really had no explanation for it. They had no reason for why the horse had to be struck that many times. And they were like, basically nothing to see here. Let's move it along. You gotta do better if you're running a racetrack than that. I'm sorry, especially in 2019. So getting back on the track, there's a big weekend this weekend in Louisville, Kentucky. It's the last big racing weekend in Kentucky till April, until Keeneland opens back up. And a lot of big races. We got the Clark on Friday night. On Saturday, we got the 2-year-olds with the Kentucky Jockey Club and the Goldenrod. And the PPs and stuff have just come out recently. But I think most people are most looking forward to, at least I don't want to speak for everybody, I think Tis the Law is the biggest draw of the weekend after passing on the Breeders' Cup. He'll now be running in the Kentucky Jockey Club, which is a pretty decent field. That's what I'm most looking forward to. I don't know if you guys have any other thoughts about the weekend's racing.
I agree. I think that's the highlight. And, you know, it was funny. We've talked about this quite a bit on the TDN Writers Room podcast. But if he wins, would anybody give him consideration for 2-year-old champion?
I mean, he's got the grade one win, so he's got that under his belt. And I, like we said, I think the nature of the Breeders' Cup Juvenile had that played out with 3 long shots across the line. I don't think it's impossible, for sure.
I'm not going to vote for this horse if he wins by 50 lengths, because I don't want to reward a horse that passed on the Breeders' Cup. And now tell me what a hypocrite I am, because, Joe,
you're going to vote for maximum security for champion 3-year-old, aren't you?
Yes, I am. Oh, well, and you know what? I don't really know how to explain that. You know, I don't really see maximum security as a horse that dodged the Breeders' Cup. I see him more as a horse that it didn't fit into his program as they were bringing him back in a sprint and they were pointing for something down the line. And also, again, you have to take into account the various divisions and whatever. So, you know, maybe I'm trying to talk out of both sides of my mouth. I understand that. But I think there are differences to the situation. And, you know, I just, again, I don't think it's good for racing. And we're seeing this pattern. And I also brought this up in print before that, you know, all of a sudden, you know, everybody with a good two-year-old, they don't want to run. It's like all they care about is winning the Derby. And, you know, everybody's convinced that you can't give these horses, you know, that many starts as a two-year-old. I mean, we've seen them with Independence Hall skipping the Remsen. We've seen them with Tissel Law skipping the Breeders' Cup. We saw it last year with Instagram, you know, pulling the plug on his two-year-old season, what, in August or something like that. And I really hope that's not a pattern that we're going to see going forward. And apparently it might be.
American Pharoah also didn't run the Breeders' Cup.
Wasn't he hurt, though?
He was.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I'd probably give it to him if he won by enough. I wouldn't normally, but with this year, it's kind of, I mean, it's tough to give it to anybody else.
I'm on the same board, I guess, as much as I don't want to vote for Storm the Court. I guess I'll probably be duty bound to if it doesn't work out the right way.
Yeah, it came out this week. He's definitely not running again as a two-year-old. He's going to run the Bob Lewis as a three-year-old first out. General feeling about, I haven't dived into it too deeply, but general feeling about this weekend's races, it's a really nice full field, especially Friday at Churchill. Mm-hmm. I think the Clark has 12 horses. The Mrs. Revere has a full field, full gate, 14. There's some good betting races in terms of star power. I don't know that you really see it. It's going to be interesting to see next weekend with the Cigar Mile if how star-studded of a field we get for that with Maximum Security showing up.
Yeah, three-year-old champion Maximum Security versus Big Ass Fans Dirt Mile winner Hard to Spun. You can't do better than that. Yeah,
nice. I think the Clark has probably been hurt maybe as much as anything by the Pegasus and now the race in Saudi Arabia and everything. It just kind of seems like an afterthought for a lot of horses. It is, like you said, a wide-open race. I thought Seeking the Soul was a little interesting just because he loves Churchill. Mm-hmm. And how about Pioneer Spirit claimed for $150,000 last time? And it was a good – I mean, the horse ran a career top. It was a gutsy claim, but – looks like a shrewd one.
Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, we'll have more thoughts on the weekend's races after they transpire next week and what they mean for the championship picture, if anything. Tough to see anything other than Tis the Law shaking things up. Also this weekend is the first Kentucky Derby future wager, pool one. It's also the only pool for the Kentucky Derby sire future wager. So 23 interests, I believe, in the sire wager. Then all other sires, 22 interests in the Kentucky Derby future pool. And then 23 is all three-year-old fillies. And then 24 is all other colts and geldings. Just want to go through the list real quick and see if there's anybody that sticks out to anyone. There's American Theorem, A No Door, Answer In, who I don't know who that is, Authentic, Basin, Dennis's Moment, Eight Rings, Governor Morris, Great Power, also above my head. Green Light Go, High Velocity, Honor AP, Independence Hall, Maxfield, Scabbard, South Bend, Storm the Court, Structor, Thousand Words, Three Technique, Tis the Law, Wrecking Crew, and then the grouped entries of all three-year-old fillies and all their colts. If I had to pick one out right here, Green Light Go is 50-1.
Yep.
He's the horse that's really kind of been forgotten about, whereas during the summer, it seemed like he was the top two-year-old in the land. Obviously, that was very early. A lot of other stuff has happened since then. But I think 50-1 is a little bit of an overlay in general. I don't like betting future wagers, but if I was going to put a couple bucks, that would be who I had it on. Dennis's Moment at 15-1 seems relatively fair. If he stays on his trajectory before the Breeders' Cup, you think he'd be much shorter than that. Maxfield, as much as I like him at 15-1, I don't like him at 51. As much as I like him as a horse, I don't like him at 15-1 just because once he had an ankle chip surgery, it's all reports is that it was a minor thing. Once these horses go on the sideline, I'm not betting on them to come back and win the Derby. It's just a general feeling of mine.
Give you two thoughts. Number one, the cinch is all others.
Yeah. And 6-5.
It's going to be 3-5. But, you know, especially usually that's what wins in the first. Yeah, I wish I had the statistics for it. But usually that's what wins in the first round anyways. I mean, you know, Justify hadn't even raced at this time in 2017. Or was it 2018?
2018, yeah, last year.
You know, but who wants to bet that at 3-5 or whatever? But I couldn't. could conscience bet on anything else? And the one thing about the future wager that drives me crazy is that, well, you can't do it now, but once the nominations for the Triple Crown are out, why can't you bet on any horse? There's no reason in this day and age to limit it to 24 betting interests. You know, if you have some, if you'd like some unraced maiden in some guy's barn at Remington Park, and, you know, there's no reason why you shouldn't be able to put $20 on that horse. It would be so much more of an interesting wager. And that's how it, you know, it traditionally was done in Las Vegas, pretty much, you know, and where the odds are a lot more attractive because you're betting among 350 horses or something like that rather than 24.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you want to bet an unraced maiden at from Remington, you have to go to Vegas and talk to the odds maker there, and hopefully they'll give you a price and all that. I had three that I thought were a little interesting. Anu Dor, I would not take it 20-1. I think he'll be higher. I think he's a legit kind of dirt grinder, mile and a quarter horse. Gouverneur Morris, I think he's interesting. Kind of strikes me as a true stretchy two-turn mile and a quarter type. Another one who skipped the Breeders' Cup. And as Joe already mentioned, Green Light Go, I think, is value. He hasn't run a lot yet, but he just seems like a horse who I think has a good chance to get to the race. And if he gets to the race, he's not going to be 50-1. And I think one really important thing to think about if you are betting these futures is to look at the sire wager, because sometimes there's value. Sometimes there's a sire who's almost the same price as an individual entry by that sire. And obviously you're getting value if you just bet the sire. Mm-hmm.
I thought Anu Dor was interesting as well. I can't talk myself off of Maxfield, just for the reason that I understand there's a bunch of unknowns, a bunch of variables. How's he going to come back? Is he going to come back? I just feel at the end of the day that assuming he makes a gate for the Derby, which is a giant assumption, I think he's 6-1 or something. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, for me, the 15-1 would still represent value. And how about Independence Hall, lower price than we see the single lowest?
And him and Storm the Court are co-favorites at 12-1, other than the all.
I find it hard to believe Storm the Court is going to close at 12-1. That's a little beyond belief for me. The other reason I brought up Green Light Go, and we talked about this before with John Green, it felt like he was a little bit ahead of schedule, especially for a Jimmy Jerkins trainee to come out of the box and win at 5.5 furlongs and then 6.5. I think maybe it was a case of a little bit too much too soon for him. Like you said, he hasn't been seen in a while. But I think once Jimmy can get him turned into a routing three-year-old, I think he's going to show what he can do. Before we move on from that, I just wanted to run down the individual sires you can bet on. There's American Pharoah, Bernardini, Bodie Meister, Candy Ride, Constitution, Curlin, Declaration of War, I was surprised to see in there, Empire Maker, Hardspun, Honor Code, Into Mischief, Liam's Map, Medaglia d'Oro, More Than Ready, Pioneer of the Nile, Quality Road, Shackleford, Spitestown, Street Sense, Tappet, Tis Now, Uncle Mo, Union Rags, and then all others. So if any of those tickle your fancy, go ahead and throw a couple bucks down. I think the morning line favorite right now is, other than the field, is Constitution at 6-1. And then after that is American Pharoah, which is pretty interesting. When's the last time? I mean, they've only been doing this for a couple of years, but I can't imagine that freshman sires have been at the top of it before. Piggybacking on previous discussions about how we can make wagering easier and fairer, we talked about the money flooding in late. This is one that doesn't get talked about that much. At least I don't see it. Is when there's a late scratch in a multi-race wager. I'm a big multi-race player, and you get automatically moved to the post time favorite, which kind of screwed me last Friday. I was betting Churchill. It had been Thursday or Friday, and I had three horses in the last leg of a live pick five, and one of them was a late scratch, and I got moved to the favorite, who I didn't like, and then the horse that I would have subbed in won, and the thing that paid like four figures. To me, that's an easy fix, and there's just no reason that you can't have alternates. For me, like if you go on Horse Tourneys or any of these online handicapping tournament sites, they give you the main pick and they give you the alternate. So really, I think it would just be another column in the wagering interface to have you be able to put an alternate in. You don't have to if you don't want to, but I just think moving it to the post time favorite, that's completely arbitrary, because there are so many races where you don't like the post time favorite at all. You might have indeed played the sequence to beat that post time favorite. And I just think that's one of the subtle things in betting horses that kind of makes you feel screwed sometimes, because you're losing based on an opinion you didn't even have to begin with. So I think that's an easy fix for racing and wagering that could avoid issues like I had last week.
I agree. I think it all just comes down to, you know, it's probably not the easiest thing to do, just updating the technology. And like most things in racing, you need a lot of impetus for people to actually get anything done. So I think that's probably what people would say, that it's too hard to do, even though it probably isn't.
Yeah, I mean, I just feel like it would be adding one column, but I don't know. I don't know specifically, obviously, what it would entail.
Right. Is there a way to do it, or was there a way to do it on the old-fashioned bet cards?
Like I thought those things at Saratoga, the parlays?
Yeah, sure.
That's a good question. Yeah, I haven't used one of those in forever, but no, you might be right about that. This is where it helped to have a call-in show. Someone can call in and school us on that. But yeah, it's just, I don't know. It's I hate losing on opinions that I didn't have. So that's a problem for me. Before we sign off for the week, I wanted to hand it over to our managing editor, Alan Carasu, who will be heading across the globe on Monday to cover the Hong Kong International Races.
16 hours, United Airlines, 777, home office for a good part. Yeah, it's something I look forward to every year. I mean, honestly, it's I always call it my Breeders' Cup, and that's not to cast or throw any shade on the Breeders' Cup, but just, you know, horses come from all over the world. It's an all-turf meeting, you know, lots of locally-based horses, a giant contingent from Japan, including Almond Eye, who's one of the top two or three horses in the world. And then, you know, a good assortment of locally-based horses, including a three-year-old. A three-year-old has never won the sprint race at the meeting, and that's, well, he'll be favored to do it this year, a horse called Athero. And just wanted to just give a heads up and look for the coverage in, most of the coverage will be in TDN Europe, some of it in the TDN Australian edition, but just give a read. I would appreciate it.
Hey, Alan, we don't, you know, this is not a political discussion, but I think it's germane or pertinent to bring this up. Going over there, do you fear the races might be canceled? Because this is such a high profile event. I would think the protesters might be thinking about, you know, doing something to disrupt the races.
So I kind of let the Hong Kong Jockey Club make my decision that if they were comfortable going ahead with it, if they were going to invite the horses and bring the horses over, then they were greenlighting the meeting. And I don't see any chance that it's going to be canceled. The location of Sha Tin is up away from the downtown area. Although the Chinese University of Hong Kong is about half a mile away from Sha Tin, where there were giant protests, and basically they set the campus on fire a couple weeks ago, but seems to have mellowed some. The answer to your question is I don't think there's any chance they're going to cancel it. But, yeah, it's certainly something that's weighed on my mind over the last 4 or 6 weeks.
Right. And we want you to be safe and want everybody to be safe. And we look forward to reading the coverage.
Thank you, sir.
So that's it for this week of the TN Writers Room podcast. We want to wish all of our listeners a happy Thanksgiving. I also want to thank Dr. Greg Ferraro, our Green Group guest of the week, Bill Finley, Alan Carasso, and Brian DiDonato. I am Joe Bianca signing off. We will see you next week.